WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
My guest is novelist Gloria Naylor. She won the 1983 American Book Award for First Fiction for her novel The Women of Brewster Place, the story of the black women who live on a rundown dead-end street. Her second book, Linden Hills, focused on life in a suburban, upwardly mobile black neighborhood. Her new novel, Mama Day, is set on a Georgia Sea island she calls Willow Springs. Like her previous works, it explores an isolated black community. Naylor says that the different settings of her novels allow her to look at broader issues faced by black Americans.
Willow Springs is not an actual place. It is based upon several of those islands that lie off the coast of Georgia and South Carolina. And that's very important symbolically to the work, because once you do cross that bridge from the mainland U.S. to Willow Springs, you've entered another reality. What intrigued me about that section of the United States and why I traveled down there to absorb the atmosphere was the fact that the blacks who lived in those islands were a people apart from even other southern blacks, because they had a separate history. And although that is changing now, I'd say within the last 20 years or so, but at one time they were terribly close-knit, and they kept several indigenous African traditions going, especially the tradition of using roots and herbs. And since that was central to the work, I just wanted to go and see these people and see this place.
Because place is so important in your fiction, I'm interested in the role of location in your life. Now, you're a native New Yorker, yeah. But your parents were from Mississippi.
That's right.
And I think they left Mississippi shortly before your birth.
I was conceived in Mississippi, as a matter of fact, and they got to New York a month before I was born. So I grew up in a very southern home within a very urban city, yeah.
Did they want you to know southern foods and southern customs, or did they want to leave that behind them when they came north?
No, it wasn't even an option. That's what we did in my home. My mom was 21 years old when she got married, so she cooked the way she cooked 3 months before she got married. They only knew one way of raising children, of expecting behavior and of shaping character, the way they'd been taught. So no, they didn't make a conscious effort, I guess, to throw off their southernness, anything of that nature. They were trying so very hard just to simply make a living, you know, because my parents weren't highly educated people, and they weren't from any wealthy backgrounds. They were southern sharecroppers.
I think that some southerners who came north felt that the northerners treated them like hicks.
Like hicks?
Yeah.
No, my folks, no, did not have that problem. It was being black Americans. It was much more a problem of racism than regionalism, mm-hmm. for them. You know, and I think the greatest shock, what they will talk about, is that they had indeed expected that New York would offer more social mobility and wider opportunities. And once they came here, they found that indeed they could now vote. In Mississippi, they were not allowed to register and vote, and the first thing they did was to register and to start voting here. But they were still at the bottom of the totem pole when it came to getting jobs. You know, there were only a few places that they were allowed to live and that they could afford to live here in New York. And what they liked about the South was the fact that although the social restrictions were so terrible, the people were more honest. At least that was the case in the 50s, you know, and they didn't care for the duplicity that they found in the North, because it was just as racist. It was ultimately revealed to them, but it took a lot longer to find out what the outside world considered your place to be.
When did you start getting interested in reading and in writing?
I cannot give you a date, because all of my conscious life, I have been fascinated with words. You know, I learned to read before I was in kindergarten, because in the 50s women didn't work. Not many women worked. And so my mother, to while away the time with us, she'd teach us to read. You know, and she'd take us to the library. And so when I hit kindergarten, I could read. And I was always fascinated somehow with the way books were put together. I remember opening them and smelling them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that kind of thing.
Yeah, certain library books really smelled a certain way.
They did in those days. I don't know if they still do.
I could never figure out whether it was the plastic cover in the library books.
Or that glue
books,
on the
glue
binding.
On the spine.
I think it was
yeah.
The glue.
Uh-huh.
I think it was the glue. We get high off the glue or something. But I've always read, always loved to write. I was when I was younger, I was very shy. And I didn't talk. And when I say I didn't talk, I mean I say good morning and pass the butter, that kind of thing. But I wouldn't talk about the things that really mattered. And to this day, that holds true to some extent. But anyway, my mother noticed when I got about 12, 13, that I wasn't discussing things that she assumed girls would want to discuss with their parents. And so she gave me this little white plastic diary, and she told me that since I didn't want to talk to her and my dad, I should put my feelings down in that diary. And that was 12, 13 years old. And I can say perhaps from that point, I began to connect, trying to articulate what was inside of me with the written word. And I still sort of see what I do as a continuum from that plastic diary.
You've said that reading Toni Morrison changed your life.
It was discovering The Bluest Eye and discovering that black women wrote. Because I, like I said, I had been writing myself and reading voraciously from 12, 13 years old, and it kept going. Even though I aborted, I don't know if you want to say aborted, I interrupted my formal education between high school and college. I took 7 years off, and I became a minister. But I was always writing, and somehow feeling illegitimate for doing that, a little freaky, for trying to write stories and trying to write poetry, because I didn't know any other black people who were doing that. And having gone through a basic high school curriculum in the mid-60s, you were not taught black writers. You were taught the English classics, and that's where I learned to love language. But I did not know about Gwendolyn Brooks, who ironically had gotten the Pulitzer Prize the year I was born, 1950. You know, I did not know about Zora Neale Hurston, Pauli Marshall, who was writing at that time. And in 77, I took a creative writing course, and we were exposed to black writers. And once I found out that indeed my story had been told by other people in various ways, it was sort of like a watershed moment in my life.
Until that point, did you feel that your own story would make for illegitimate fiction because you hadn't read other fiction like it?
No, I hadn't even conceptualized of my having a story. It wasn't even a matter of it being illegitimate fiction. It was a matter of my not thinking that there was a story to be told. You know, what I think now of benign neglect, if you will, on the part of academia at that time.
You mentioned that you became a minister for 7 years.
Right.
You were actually a minister in the Jehovah's Witnesses, right?
That's right. I traveled when I was a missionary for them.
How did you get involved with the Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, it was the latter part of the 60s, and the world was going to hell. You know, I was looking at the United States Army invade Southeast Asia, United States Army come into Harlem and invade our streets. And I just thought that there was no hope for this world as long as men were ruling it, any type of men. And so that organization just hit a chord with me because they preached about a government, a theocracy, a government ruled by God. So men would have no say in it whatsoever, and that there would be this paradise here on earth. And so when you have a belief, you know, I was always taught that you put your money where your mouth is and you work for that belief.
Do you think in a way that being a Jehovah's Witness exposed you to interesting people and interesting places that ultimately helped you as a writer?
What it did, yeah. It taught me to care about people. And it also, it got me to open my mouth. I'd said, told you before, I didn't talk.
Yeah.
Well, when I had a purpose, it helped to get over the shyness when I thought that indeed I was going to save some individual. I learned to open my mouth and to speak to them.
Do you think that the gap that was left in your life when you left the Jehovah's Witnesses has been filled by something else, a spiritual gap?
You know, that I don't know. I think that's yet to be determined. Because maybe when I'm in my 40s or so, I can look back and see what all of this means and what it's given me. I do know this, that writing has always, before Jehovah's Witnesses, before junior high school, whatever, it's always somehow made me feel complete. And that is happening now. My life's become more complicated because my work is turned into a product, you know, and then people respond to a product and they respond to you via the product. But as far as the process itself, that's doing for me what it did for me when I was 12, 13 years old.
Okay, Gloria Naylor, I want to thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Gloria Naylor's new novel, Mama Day, is published by Tickner and Fields. She spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. This is Fresh Air.